All right. Thanks so much for being on the call tonight, everyone. Welcome to this week's Citizens Climate University. And tonight we're lucky enough to have Team Oil leaders Liz Fisher, Bill Bray, along with Jeff Newman in a hands-on lesson to help all of us understand the fossil fuel industry and learn more about its history and its thought leaders and how to hone our messages about the support for the fossil fuel industry on carbon pricing. So without further ado, I'll hand it off to you, Liz, and welcome everyone to tonight's lesson on communicating about oil and gas's support for carbon pricing. Here's Liz Fisher. I'm a
chemical engineer from MIT. I've spent 27 years in the petrochemical industry working for Rohm & Haas and Clorox in various areas, engineering, environmental management, and then finally I was director of manufacturing. So I'm going to be talking to you about Team Oil. Bill, and you can see, Bill has quite a few credentials for CCL. He does a lot for us. And he is the Team Oil co-lead and also our ExxonMobil liaison. He's a naval architect from the University of Michigan. He's worked for Exxon for 33 years, retired after 33 years, working as a naval architect, an engineer, and a manager in shipping and offshore oil production. And then Jeff is going to talk to us about Shell. He's a geologist and a professional geologist, both in California and Texas. He's got a geology degree, no surprise, from UCLA, and worked for both Texaco and Shell for 35 years in exploration, environmental, risk management, and communication. And by the way, Jeff and Bill are next door neighbors down in the Woodlands, Texas. So that's pretty cool. Our learning goals for tonight, and I hope this matches your goals, are to understand the reasoning behind why the large integrated oil and gas companies support carbon pricing. And both Jeff and Bill are going to talk about that from Exxon and Shell's viewpoint, which also goes along with a lot of the other companies. Then we hope you'll be able to leverage that support of the oil and gas companies for carbon fee and dividend when meeting with members of the of Congress or members of the general public. And we'll also provide a lot of video clips, presentations, and citations showing the support, so you can use them as drop-in slides in any of your presentations. And then finally, we want you to use Team Oil. So we are happy to answer questions. We're happy to make presentations, even attend meetings by conference call, or as we were talking earlier, Larry Kramer is even willing to drive to Louisiana. So any questions you have on how the oil industry operates, how it's organized, what the positions are on climate change, on carbon pricing, feel free to ask us. And our contact information is at the end of the presentation. So our agenda for the night is, I'll just give you one slide on the team oil, and then we'll move to Bill, who'll talk about ExxonMobil and their positions on carbon pricing. Then we hope to have time for a couple of questions that you can submit through the chat window for Bill. Then we'll move on to Jeff on Shell and carbon pricing, have time for a couple more questions via the chat window. Then I'll finish up with a run through of some of our projects that I hope you find useful. And then just a summary of what we talked about tonight, and then we'll open it up to a more open forum where you can ask questions of any of us. Okay, so a little bit about Team Oil. And those logos there are from all the companies that are represented on Team Oil. There's a few more, but those are the main oil and gas companies that are represented on Team Oil. And thank you, Brett, for putting all those on there. So our mission for Team Oil, oh, and by the way, OIL stands for Oil and Gas Industry Liaisons. That's why it's, OIL. We don't include coal. There is a coal country action team led by Jim Probst that manages all of issues with coal. So we're just oil and gas. And we are the liaisons. We have good relationships with Exxon, Shell, the American Petroleum Institute, the American Association of Petroleum Geologists, the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, And we have also talked to Shell, the Koch Brothers Public Sector, the Western States Petroleum Association, American Chemical Council, and they're either not as receptive to our message, or they don't really deal with NGOs, or they would prefer that we focus more on the types of solutions that were brought up at our last national meeting in the drawdown project. But we're still working. Even if they're resistant, we still, in CCL's way, push forward. And then we're also the resident experts, so we do hope you'll use us as experts on oil and gas industry. Our members are mostly from the Oil and Gas and Petroleum Institute. We have a lot of scientists and engineers, but we've also got on our mailing list, there's about 50% who are not from the oil and gas industry, but want to learn. We've got teachers, economists, two emergency room physicians, and others. And we welcome guests and new members. So if you want to just come to one meeting to learn or to ask a question, that's absolutely fine. Our meetings are on the second Wednesday and the fourth Wednesday of the month. First, the second Wednesday, it's sort of a general meeting. The fourth Wednesday, we usually have a guest speaker where we just concentrate on a single issue. And then you can see there below the call-in information. You can either call in with that number or you can join us by the web with the Uber website. And on that Uber website, we have recordings of past conferences, so you can listen to those as well. And I also put out notes from the meetings. So I think without further ado, we'll just move on to Bill and the Exxon.
Thanks, Liz. Thanks for this opportunity, Brett, and thanks to all of you for your time and listening to us today. Team Oil thinks that we have a message that can really help us, CCL, move our carbon fee and dividend forward significantly. I retired from Exxon, so I no longer represent them. But I am CCL's liaison with ExxonMobil and meet or talk to their corporate greenhouse gas manager routinely. So I do have a pretty good understanding of their position on climate change and understand their language. We have some clips from ExxonMobil CEOs, so we'll let you hear from them directly, but I'll also give you my take on them. First, here's my take on why ExxonMobil and most of the oil and gas majors support carbon pricing. It avoids regulation, which are static and not very effective relative to market-based drivers. It's predictable rather than changing with every administration, and a legislated increase in carbon price is stable. It's simple, fit, transparent, and fair relative to a myriad of subsidies, incentives, and rules. And it allows each company to compete effectively, and that's what they want. The majors expect that it's going to drive efficiency improvement, and they view this as the lowest hanging fruit for reducing emissions. It favors gas over coal, which is good for their business, and it supports carbon capture and sequestration, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. And it enables an orderly and efficient transition, which they know is needed and inevitable. In 2007, Rex Tillerson became ExxonMobil's CEO. Within 2 years, he changed the company's position on climate change and the need for action almost 180 degrees. A large corporation like EM has a whole lot of inertia, so it's not just issuing a single order. It took some real energy on his part to make this change in a relatively short time. Here's a clip from Exxon at the Economic Club of Washington in 2009.
Emissions. That other option is a revenue neutral carbon tax. I know that's hard for a politician to say. So we've given them a new name. They can call it a refundable greenhouse gas emissions fee. Because a carbon tax is directly applied to the carbon content of fossil fuels or to other greenhouse gas emissions, there is no need for government to pick winners and losers in the industry through such complex allowance and allocation processes as we have witnessed on the Hill of late.
That was when cap and trade was under consideration. And Rex was talking about why revenue neutral carbon tax is the best policy. And it's when cap and trade was being considered in Congress. And EM was pointing out the huge benefits of a revenue neutral carbon tax that I think most CCLers agree with. Some would say that EM only held this position to scuttle cap and trade, but EM has consistently advocated for a revenue neutral carbon tax since then. This is ExxonMobil's corporate website with a link to the statement supporting carbon tax. It's from 2015, but it's still valid today, and this is a great thing to point others to when they need a link on what Exxon says. While I would like Exxon to be more vocal, in their view, they are being vocal. In response to a New York Times article, Susan McCarron, VP for Public and Government Affairs, wrote, "ExxonMobil executives have repeatedly made clear the company's position in briefings, some 300 in 2015 alone, including with members of Congress and in media interviews, as well as in other communications. And EM is all about metrics, so if they're counting the briefings, it's important to them." This is my favorite cartoon. It was printed in the Houston Chronicle right after Exxon executives came down and talked to the Chronicle editorial staff explaining why they knew climate change is real, the risk is real, and the government should take action. This is great tabling material. Print this out, have it on a table. People see it and ask about it and chuckle. And you can use it to start a conversation about oil majors' support. Let's fast forward to December 2016 when Rex was being interviewed for Secretary of State. Here he gives his view on climate change and ExxonMobil's approach to managing climate risk.
So the grand challenge for us, for ExxonMobil and for the people in my industry, is how are we going to meet the world's energy needs in the future and do it in a way that is environmentally responsible and manages this risk of climate change? And it involves a lot of trade-offs. And the thing that I get most disheartened about in our public debate is that most of the public discourse is at both extremes. It's at both extremes, you know. And that's not where the solution's going to be found. The solution's going to be found by thoughtful people coming into the middle and saying, yeah, it's a risk. I know I don't know how this is going to turn out. I got to do things that make sense for the long term, for the economy. And we got a lot of competing priorities, and we're just going to have to manage those. It's not a discussion that we can find very many people willing to have, and that is very disheartening to me.
So his conclusion is a great selling point for CCL and our carbon fee and dividend. Public debate is at the extremes on both sides, and our society needs to get into the middle where we can find solutions. Our carbon fee and dividend is in the middle. And that means it's doable in today's environment. CCL sees our CF&D as the best first step to addressing climate change. We need to be laser focused on this first step. We're aligned with the oil majors on this, and let's use the powerful lever that they are providing. CERAWeek is one of the world's largest energy conferences. The picture on the left is the front page of the Houston Chronicle's business section after CERAWeek. They're believers, climate change is real, with a picture of the Saudi energy minister. That would have been unthinkable just a few years ago. The article went on to talk about CERAWeek and climate change, and the only policy solution they talked about was a carbon tax. There were also other publications that had the same take on CERAWeek. In the bottom corner is Darren Woods, ExxonMobil's new CEO, who succeeded Rex. As far as I've seen, he continues Rex's positive approach on the need for addressing climate change and taking action. We have a minute of Darren's half-hour speech near the beginning of the conference.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate the opportunity to join and speak with the leaders of our industry. CERAWeek is our world stage. Today, I want to talk about growth, not only energy and economic growth, but also growth and environmental progress. I want to challenge the assumption made by many that a growing economy and a cleaner environment are mutually exclusive, that as we step forward in developing more oil and natural gas, our environment, including our climate, must step back. All of us share the same aspirations to live in a world that is clean and safe and prosperous, a place where our children can grow up looking forward to healthy and happy lives with higher standards of living. Affordable energy plays an important role in achieving this. I believe the assumption that affordable energy and a cleaner environment are a zero-sum game is mistaken. It underestimates the power of technology. The zero-sum view is a static one, and the world of energy is anything but static.
He says technology is going to enable that and spends most of the talk describing various technologies that ExxonMobil is working on and developing that reduce greenhouse gas emissions as well as provide energy. For each technology, he quotes the millions of metric tons of CO2 emission reductions or the number of cars that are going to be taken off the road with this or that technology. So he puts everything in the framework of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. I'd like to talk a minute about carbon capture and storage and ExxonMobil's view on it. EM claims to be involved in a quarter of the CCS projects in the US. They see this as a huge enabler for inexpensive energy with essentially no greenhouse gas emissions. Their energy outlook, which is the basis for all their economic decisions, has a tremendous amount of info on the EM view of energy use out to 2040. A link to this report is at the bottom of the screen here. In the energy outlook, the price of CO2 emissions rises to $80 a metric ton. So this is their internal price of carbon that is baked into all their economic analysis. EM is driven by efficiency, engineering efficiency, and economic efficiency. I surmise, but I haven't seen it in print anywhere, that Exxon's view is when the price of CO2 emissions rises to $80 per metric ton, that CCS will be economic for power plants and many big manufacturing facilities. I think their view is that what we need as the first big step is a signal that will make CCS work at scale and reduce huge amounts of greenhouse gas emissions and enable use of natural gas. And this is basically the same view as the REMI report. This is U.S. power generation on the left without and on the right with CF&D. Blue is coal and basically goes away by 2025 with CF&D. Orange is natural gas, and the orange bars are gas with CCS. So CF&D drives natural gas to CCS, but still with significant volumes. In 2040, 20% of our electrical energy is coming from natural gas still. Darren concludes by announcing ExxonMobil's Growing the Gulf effort, investing $20 billion in 11 projects in the Gulf of Mexico coastal areas and creating 45,000 direct jobs. He not only says economic growth and greenhouse gas emission reductions are possible, he says we're doing it on a significant scale. You don't need to like ExxonMobil or their business model. We don't need to agree on fracking or pipelines or all the other issues out there. We do agree with ExxonMobil on almost all the key items of carbon taxing, and we, CCL, need to stay laser focused on that. Darren is saying we can have economic growth and still address climate change. A lot of the conservative, skeptic, denialist view is driven by folks afraid of losing our wonderful standard of living. Darren's message is perfect for these folks. Here he says, we're growing the economy and jobs while reducing greenhouse gas emissions. They are not mutually exclusive. The CEO of the world's largest international oil company is clearly in the conservative tribe. Most of the attendees at CERAWeek are in the conservative tribe. These are folks that conservatives will listen to. Another powerful tool is Climate Leadership's Council Carbon Dividend. And this is especially good with conservatives. CCL and CLC work together to position CLC as a more conservative alternative. So let's use it. Exxon, Shell, BP, and Total, most of the super majors, are founding members of CLC. You can see their supporting members on the website by hovering over it. I won't read the whole statement, but ExxonMobil believes the goal of a carbon policy should be to reduce emissions at the lowest cost to society. Talks about a revenue-neutral carbon tax as the only policy, and it says we are pleased to support the Climate Leadership Council as a founding member. So you can use this and point to this. So the oil industry is providing us powerful levers. Let's use them in talks, tabling, in our writing, in our elevator talks. Please use this lever, especially when talking to folks who are concerned with the economic impacts of taking action. The fact that the oil and gas majors are promoting carbon price as the economically efficient way of addressing needed action is a tremendous lever with these folks. Tell your members of Congress, cite examples of oil major support, and ask them to bring it up in meetings with the oil majors. This is especially effective with conservative members of Congress. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for your wonderful efforts at CCL. I look forward to your questions, and keep calm and price carbon.
Okay, thank you, Bill. So now we will move on to Jeff with Shell.
There we go. Okay. So, of course, this is the Shell part of the talk. I'd like to share three topics, really. One is recent directional changes that have been made by Shell that are consistent with the expectation that carbon will be priced. Next is to look at sustainability and scenarios planning as a context for Shell's position on climate change and carbon pricing. And finally, Shell's direct acknowledgments of climate change and support for government-led carbon pricing directly from their website. Briefly, Shell is 110 years old, but just looking at some very recent direction changes, we see them forming a major joint venture around Brazilian ethanol from sugarcane. We see last year the acquisition of BG Group, formerly British Gas, which was acquired because of their gas reserves as well as some acreage offshore Brazil. With this action, Shell surpassed Chevron 2 as the number two non-state oil company behind Exxon, and this increases Shell's stake in natural gas. The crude way of saying this, of course, this is all just too punny, is saying that Shell becomes a much gassier company after this acquisition. And finally, this year they announced divestment of their interest in the Canadian oil sands. Next. So David Hone is the chief climate advisor at climate change advisor for Shell, and there is a section of the Shell.com website dedicated to David Hone's activities, and where he looks at recent changes. So this is his perspective on important recent changes within Shell. He notes the formation of a carbon trading desk within the Shell Trading Group. This is under three CEOs ago. Under two CEOs ago, Jeroen van der Veer created a CO2 team and gave it very high visibility within the company. I can speak directly that one of my last projects at Shell was an LNG project, and we did have to look at the CO2 implications of that LNG project and report to this team. Finally, the new energies business was started up last year and given quite a bit of funding. The current CEO champions issues on this, such as government-implemented carbon pricing. And I can speak personally here. One of the jobs I applied for before I left Shell was a job looking at electric car charging stations that are engineered to sell peak demand back to the grid for very short periods of time. So there's some really exciting things that that group is looking at. And then finally, on the next slide, we'll talk about Shell scenarios. But one of the last things that David Hone highlighted was the scenarios group doing a net zero emissions energy system of the future analysis. This is a blue sky thinking group, and they went to them some years ago and said, okay, what could a net zero emissions future look like? Do the thinking and show me an example. And so Shell has done that thinking and documented it. Next slide, please. Two things here. Two things that every company does is looking at highlighting successes, and Shell does this with a sustainability report. This is something that's published every year. And the second thing that Shell does is the scenarios group, which ponders the future. This is kind of the corporate version of what am I going to be when I grow up? It looks at in 10, 20, and 50 years out, will our business model remain viable? How do we need to adapt and what new opportunities are out there where we could have a competitive advantage? I'll give two examples of the spectacular failures at this. That would be Kodak and Xerox. Kodak was so married to photographic film that they failed to prepare for digital photography. And Xerox was so married to the office copier's success that they failed to prepare for, I won't call it the paperless office, but we'll call it the less paper office. So Shell's sustainability report gives results on social and environmental initiatives and metrics. In the speaker's notes, when these slides get released, there will be links to the latest report and to a video that talks about what that report does and what the group behind it does. We'll skip that in the interest of time. However, on the scenario side, we will look at a quick video that talks about what Shell does with scenario planning.
One of the most crucial aspects of our energy modelling and scenario quantification is how much energy in total is the world going to use in 2050.
The scenarios team is a bunch of people with rich imagination, I would say.
We have a lot of very different people with very different backgrounds, thinking about how things connect together like a really intricate jigsaw puzzle. We have political scientists, economists, geopolitical experts.
There's lots of people who are producing projections for how the world might evolve.
Really, we try to simplify the complexity all around us.
We in the scenarios team are currently putting a lot of attention into cities and city development.
There's a lot of new cities being built in the developing world. So how those cities develop, how compact they are going to be, how the transport infrastructure is going to be laid out particularly, are going to be absolutely crucial.
The choices about combined heat and power generation, public mass transport, and vehicle efficiency will have a big impact on the future global energy demand.
Decisions that we take now are going to have a major impact on decades to come.
Okay, so next thing we're going to do is look at a couple of the key statements on Shell's website. This is the statement about climate change. They come right out and say, we recognize the significance of climate change along with the role that energy plays in helping people achieve and maintain a good quality of life. At the end there, it says that the transition to low carbon solutions is best underpinned by meaningful government-led carbon pricing mechanisms. So you can't get more unequivocal than that. Next slide. carbon pricing. Shell supports establishment of government-led carbon pricing mechanisms that deliver a meaningful cost on CO2 emissions necessary to create a shift to lower carbon power and fuel options. They talk about taxing, they talk about cap and trade, they talk about carbon fee and dividend type of solutions. And as we'll see on this slide is where I'd like to play the David Hone video. So this is an extensive video from David Hone, again, the Shell climate lead advisor, talking about why Shell thinks this is the solution.
Hydrocarbons are the foundation of modern society. Everything from the cars we drive to the clothes we wear is powered, created, or delivered by their energy. That means almost everything we make and consume indirectly creates carbon dioxide, the byproduct of using fossil fuels. In fact, every day we create enough carbon dioxide to cover an island the size of Manhattan with a 4 kilometer high pyramid. Did you know the making and use of a smartphone creates the equivalent of 100 kilograms of carbon dioxide? That's about the same as burning around a third of a barrel of oil. So how does society meet the growing demand for energy while limiting carbon dioxide emissions? The challenge is to create an economic incentive that controls emissions without limiting the goods and services that hydrocarbons deliver. A solution is for governments to implement carbon pricing policies. There are two main ways of doing this. The first option is for governments to tax emissions, which directly establishes a price for emitting carbon dioxide. This tax can be offset by a reduction in other taxes, which is what they've done in British Columbia. The alternative is to cap emissions, then allow a price to develop through the trading of allowances. This is the route adopted in Europe. Both routes are effective and can drive innovation and change. Getting governments to create a price for carbon is the most direct way of changing the existing equation. For example, this approach will stimulate the development of low carbon technologies, like carbon capture and storage, or help lower carbon fuels like natural gas replace higher carbon ones. Carbon capture and storage can limit the amount of carbon dioxide being emitted when we use hydrocarbons to fuel power stations and industry. Emissions are captured and injected deep into the ground. Carbon pricing policies are designed to change the cost of goods and services, favoring those that result in lower emissions. That is why they work so well. Both the tax and trade-based approach deliver new revenue to the government, which can be used to ensure that consumers are not left out of pocket. The end result should be a virtuous circle, which sees emissions fall whilst maintaining living standards. But a price needs to be put on carbon globally for it to be truly effective. Well-designed policy frameworks have to be in place, with national and regional governments taking the lead, and the United Nations providing support. In fact, globally connected carbon pricing policies are an essential tool in tackling climate change. They'll kickstart a range of measures to shift energy investment worldwide and help the least developed economies build sustainable energy systems. And with strong political backing, their implementation will be straightforward. This in turn creates opportunities for low carbon fuels, products and services, all of which makes carbon pricing a powerful, business-focused measure for limiting emissions.
About putting a price on carbon. It doesn't matter how you put a price on carbon, as long as there is one. So in the past, we have been I think, somewhat way late as an industry or as companies to have an endless debate on whether it should be a cap and trade or a carbon tax or something else. It doesn't matter as long as there is one. And I think the same is true for carbon capture and storage. Let's get on the learning curve, and then I think we can talk about how we apply it.
I'm afraid we're going to have... Okay, so I like that video. It's very much like Shell's senior management. Don't care how you do it, just let's get something in place and let's get on the learning curve with these things sooner than later. In this case, Ben Van Beurden has talked about carbon pricing on the order of $60 to $80 a ton, consistent with the kind of numbers that Bill was showing. This is the level where Shell thinks that actions will be forced. And of course, his statement, it doesn't matter how we do it, let's start this experiment and see where it takes us. Next slide. This is a reaction to the Paris Agreement and recent political developments. There was an NPR study story done in just in May, and comes right out again and says we believe climate change is real. Goes on to say that we want to be part of that solution. We think the United States needs to be part of that solution, and we're very disappointed in recent developments. Pulling out of Paris in that sense is incompatible with that goal. So again, Shell has been very unequivocal about support for Paris and disappointment with the recent politics here. We've talked already about why the majors support this. I don't need to read all the bullets. You can see in this case, David Hone gave a presentation in January of 2015. There's an article on the CCL site under Liz Fisher's byline talking about some words that CCL had with David Hone after that presentation. And this is an article resulting from that. So highlights there. We can go ahead on to the next slide. And this is kind of, this is my summary of what I think are kind of the big picture reasons, as well as a little bit of reading between the lines. Shell acknowledges global climate change and energy's role in that. And so really support for carbon pricing becomes a natural reaction to that. They see consistency, which we've already talked about. If you imagine the lack of something like this is going to lead to thousands of locally produced solutions. These are going to be motivated by local animosities, concepts and misconceptions, by the classic NIMBY or not in my backyard kind of thing. You know, we're all familiar with opposition to activities offshore, activities in the tar sands, fracking, activities in the Arctic. This is a way to put things on an equal footing and make it so that the carbon dioxide pricing is really what's driving this. It also puts the national oil companies on an equal footing with the international oil companies. We haven't talked about this yet on this presentation, but if you look at the Exxons and the Shells and so on, and you compare them to the Saudi Aramcos and Rosneft and Pemex and PDVSA and companies like that, the world production picture is really turning in favor of the national oil companies and putting the international oil companies more on relative sidelines. Number three, rationality. There are movements like countering the leave it in the ground movement, where you avoid arbitrary and locally driven solutions. And again, you go to a macroeconomic solution, which is really going to define what can be produced and transported and refined economically. Cost of compliance. If you look at an arbitrary standard, this has to be measured, reported, audited, argued, and especially when these things come with criminal sanctions, the cost of compliance is very high, and those costs get passed down through the economy and into the products. A carbon fee and dividend would disfavor coal. which, you know, globally coal is plentiful and cheap, and anything that disfavors coal is going to get the support of the international oil companies. It favors natural gas. If you look at large companies like Exxon and Shell, both have major initiatives around natural gas and having that become a greater part of the business. This favors that. And then finally, it puts us on a path to ending subsidies to renewables. If you look at the multi-year planning that's required on the part of a large company reacting to government-led solutions, nothing is more disruptive than very short-term subsidies and changes to those subsidies. It makes it very hard to invest and run a productive business. The picture here is of a Shell prototype station with a hydrogen island, and the sign on the minivan says the road to hydrogen. So I just thought that was a great look to the future to end my segment with.
Questions. Thank you so much, Jeff, for your presentation. We'll give it back to you, Liz.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to talk about some of Team Oil's tools and projects. You know, our primary thing is developing relationships within the oil and gas industry, and you've seen our what has resulted with Shell and Exxon from Bill and Jeff's slides. And we communicate not only within the industry, but then we communicate out from the industry to other CCLers, like we're doing here, or to the general public about industry positions on climate change and carbon pricing. And in doing both of those two steps, we have a really good database where we track oil and gas company support for carbon pricing and CFD. So on the next slide, you can go through the bullet points. These other projects I have individual slides for. So on the next slide, I talk about this tracking. So we can go to the next slide. We've got a good database on our Buddy Drive. And if you go to CCL Community, Team Oil, on our Buddy Drive, we have two files. One is a compilation of all of the oil companies' positions on carbon, on climate change and solutions to climate change based on their websites. And then another thing is we've got hot links, as you see here, like under Asked. If you click on Asked, it goes to the particular reference on this citation. So we've got all these hot links to oil companies speaking out on carbon pricing. So the three bullet points I have here are, in addition to what you've heard from Exxon and Shell, there were six of the European oil companies who asked Christiana Figueres to include carbon pricing in the Paris Accord. They wrote her a letter before the accord. Statoil attended the first Climate Solutions Caucus, and they were the only company, no high-tech companies came. It was just Statoil, and they were there to ask for a carbon tax. And then, as Bill alluded to before, Exxon, Shell, BP, and Total became founding members of the Climate Leadership Council. Now, I think we'll move on. There it is. So we do need to acknowledge that not all of industry supports climate action. Generally, the large integrated publicly traded companies do, you know, the Exxon, Shell, Total, BP, Statoil. But some of the smaller and mid-sized companies see it as threatening their livelihood. The privately owned ones, the specialized ones. But as Bill mentioned, it's not as bad as they think. We don't think at this point that it's really going to be as bad as they think. So we've got another project on that. But, you know, the oil majors support carbon pricing, and we need to leverage that. Not necessarily all of the industry supports it. So our next project, the Remy Report actually, go back. The Remy Report actually came out of Team Oil when Jessica Langerman and Kathy Carruthers from Massachusetts came to one of our meetings and presented their REMI study that they did on a smaller scale for Massachusetts. And we thought it looked so good that we pursued doing it nationally for our national carbon fee and dividend, got the $100,000 together that we needed to pay REMI to do it, and really the rest is history. I include this chart here, even though you already saw that in Bill's presentation, just because it is so important for the oil and gas industry that natural gas still remains robust, even after 20 years with carbon fee and dividend. Okay, and then our next project will be presented on CCU September 14th. So I'm not gonna go into a lot of detail on it, but the teaser is, you know, we all say CCL, CFD, we will apply the tax at the source as far upstream as possible, at the wellhead or mine mouth, but what does that really mean? Well, Rick Knight led a group and produced a fantastic 14-page paper that answers that question. He shows the supply chain the supply chain for gas down here at the bottom of the slide. He's got this, goes through the supply chain for gas, oil, and coal, looks at various places where we could put the tax, and then explains why it's best to put it at these three places that are listed on the slide. And you'll hear more about that directly from Rick and Larry Kramer next month on CCU. So I encourage you to attend that. And then two projects that we're working on now. One is this jobs study where we're trying to get into more detail on how CFD will affect oil and gas jobs. And the message is, and it's clear in REMI, that it's gradual change over a generation. You know, 20 years, gradual change, less than 1% per year over the whole country. And I think Shell's CEO put it best when he says that transitioning in a more or less ordered way to a low carbon society is less draconian than the booms and busts that the industry has always had and that were especially bad over the past 2 years. So I think we need to keep that front of mind. And sure enough, the REMI report backs that up with natural gas remaining robust with pollution controls, not unabated. And then it shows job losses of not really all that much over 20 years. And there's a report from University of Massachusetts Perry Group that says for the Paris Accord, granted it's not our CFD, ours would you know, be a little bit more severe, but if the US just complied with the Paris Accord, 83% of the job loss could be handled through retirements. So our study is going to look at those areas of the country where things will be worse. Yeah, it's 1% per year over the whole country, but there's going to be pockets that are more heavily affected than the whole country. So we're going to look at them and see how they are affected. How bad is it? But even if there are some people who are made redundant, people in the oil and gas industry have a lot of transferable skills, and there's a lot of growing in industries in which those skills can be used. So whether it's a scientist or an engineer or a skilled worker, like a driller or a worker, an operator, and an electrician, you know, hopefully we'll have big infrastructure projects under Trump, manufacturing, transportation. Joe Shirell's on the line. He went from oil and gas to pharmaceuticals. I went from petrochemicals to consumer goods. So we're going to look at how those transitions happened with the booms and busts and how they can happen with our carbon fee and dividend. And then the last thing we're working on is this workshop for high oil and gas areas. And it goes in combination with this job study. But we're working specifically with Jessica Schultz in Louisiana and Marianne Backrack in Oklahoma and some of their people, because they are some of the high oil and gas areas. And they also have some of the mid and small companies that may be affected a little bit more, or at least have higher fears of how they're going to be affected than the big oil and gas companies. So with that job study and the strategy workshop, we hope to be able to address that. So the workshop will be a one-day workshop. We've got it scheduled for September in Louisiana, probably sometime in October by conference call with Oklahoma. And it consists of education about the oil and gas industry provided by Team Oil so that the locals who aren't in the industry can feel more comfortable talking about, talking with, talking to the oil and gas industry. And then we'll have the local CCL chapters come with an understanding of the situation in their local area. What are the regional and local industries? How many workers? What segments of the industry. What are their concerns? What are their questions? Who are the major influencers? And then together, we'd work on a strategy and messaging to use with those influencers and members of Congress to get them on board with our carbon fee and dividend. And then we'd seize the opportunities, and they've already identified a lot of opportunities to which we can apply this. So that's great. So that's basically the end of our presentation. I hope that you will come away from this presentation understanding that big oil, maybe not all of the oil industry, but big oil supports carbon pricing, carbon taxes, and carbon fee and dividend for multiple reasons. And you heard them from Bill, heard them from Jeff. These are mine. I think, you know, the predictability for their long projects of 10 to 20 years is really important. And, you know, again, I'll repeat, favoring natural gas and making carbon capture and storage cost effective. And we can leverage that support independent of how we feel on DAPL, keep it in the ground, Exxon New, no fracking. On this particular issue, this carbon price on which we're laser focused, we do have allies. And I think if we deny those allies, then we play into the hands of the deniers who don't want anything to happen. Because if they can just keep us fighting with our allies, they don't even have to show up and nothing will happen. So I really encourage you to leverage this. And our action ideas: spread the word about this support. Ask your member of Congress to engage with oil companies about carbon pricing, especially the ones that we know support even carbon fee and dividend. And then welcome oil and gas and petrochemical employees to your group and ferry them on to Team Oil. We can always use more people. And then I do encourage everyone, whether you're in the petrochemical industry or you're not, maybe especially if you're not, to use Team Oil. We're all happy to answer questions. You're welcome to come to a meeting just to learn, just to ask a question. You know, you don't have to be in the petrochemical industry to be a contributor and to ask good questions and make good points. So our contact information is on the next slide. I'm happy to answer any emails. I'm pretty good at emails, except when I've got a presentation to make. And Bill can answer any questions on Exxon, Jeff on Shell, and then Brett on any of these, getting to any of the CCU lessons. That Team Oil toolkit, the website that's listed there, when you follow that link, you do have to page down to get to Team Oil, but there are a lot of references there, and a lot of the stuff that I presented is in that section. And then also, as I said, you can go to our Team Oil Buddy Drive and find a lot of the links to some of the sources that we talked about already. And there's a lot of good information. That's our toolkit on our Team Oil Buddy Drive. So I think that's it for our presentation. Thank you all for joining us.
Just a huge round of applause again for everyone's participation tonight, and especially for the expertise that Bill and Jeff and Liz have brought. Thank you so much for being on the call.